This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's caves might be the place to go if you're looking to beat the heat this summer. We'll talk to a caver about respectfully and safely exploring caves around the state. Now, law enforcement agencies in some states are preparing for potential civil unrest, maybe even violence, as a result of the leaked Supreme Court draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade. At the federal level, the Senate just passed a bill to give police protection to Supreme Court justices and their families. Over the weekend, an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison was set on fire. In addition to the arson in Madison, there have been a couple acts of vandalism and attempted arson at other anti-abortion groups around the country. This comes after a long history of vandalism and violence targeting abortion providers, including a couple of mass shootings at clinics, a 2012 arson attack at an Appleton clinic, and a still unsolved arson attack at a Knoxville, Tennessee abortion provider last New Year's Eve. Our next guest is an expert on extremism and violence. He worries that our current political and social environment is a bunch of dry kindling waiting for a match. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this arson incident at an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison? What do you think motivates people to commit acts of political violence? What do you want to know about extremist ideology? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Levin is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we turn to some of the wider issues, Brian, this particular incident in Madison, you know, there's been an online claim of responsibility from a as yet unknown group. Things just look kind of vague. No arrests or charges filed as of our speaking here now. What do you make of this event coming in the aftermath of the leak of the Supreme Court document?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell the connections of who did this stuff. But we've seen this in other states, as you'd mentioned, including Texas, for instance. In this particular instance, the language used, the reference to Jane's Revenge, which was a collective that actually you have an article on your website about from decades ago, and the use of intermediaries and Bellingcat to get the message out signals to me that this is probably more than just a solo actor. And someone who is part of some kind, and it could be a very small and even informal association of individuals who are looking to this as an inflection point. And understandably so, Wisconsin and the nation as a whole has been both relying on this as precedent for decades and the majority, as I said, indicated by numerous polls, both in Wisconsin and nationally, do not want these kinds of restrictions on abortion.
Looking at a slightly longer view now, this has been a contentious issue since before Roe v. Wade was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court about 50 years ago. There has been violence, sometimes lethal, sometimes in the forms of vandalism and arson attacks. What have we seen over the last few decades when it comes to extremist violence and other acts related to the abortion debate?
Well, what we have seen from Eric Robert Rudolph's attack, for instance, in the mid-1990s, to attacks, a fatal one in Buffalo, New York as well. The group, the Army of God, which was this informal association. But here's the thing. What I think is so interesting is when generally, and I want to be careful here, but generally when there is a change in legal status of something that is very emotionally tied to people, whether it's what we've seen during COVID, for instance, or in this case, you will see people who feel when legal avenues are cut off that they will go extrajudicially. And since we're having such a sudden change, I worry about a couple of things. One, that this is a catalytic event. And one of the things our data has showed us is that spikes in intergroup conflict are lasting longer. There's more traction with it. And around conflictual election seasons where there are likely flips, we've also seen escalation in aggression and even violence. So what I think, though, what you can see here. Look at what we've had in Wisconsin, for instance. During the social justice protests, we had the evolution of these civil guards. We now have this kind of thing that's been occurring for some time. Just bear with me. When we see an increase in conflictual rallies, conflictual public demonstrations, oftentimes one side will use some kind of aggression or even frequency as a way to rally the troops. So what I'm worried about is that when we see things like this, there will be a reverberative effect on the next group that would be the 2023 Proud Boys, whatever they may be, or the 2023 Oath Keepers. Particularly as we go into political seasons, some of the reverberations and side effects of legitimate issues of public debate and protest around it are those who will capitalize on it. And what I'm afraid is on the hard right side, we have people who want to be like shock troops to respond to any kind of aggression. And this is a kind of a first salvo that appears to be coming from the hard left.
Talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, looking at extremism, violence, and the abortion debate, and what might happen if Roe v. Wade is overturned. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What worries do you have? What do you think it'll take to keep an important debate civil from spilling over into forms of violence? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christian is with us in Green Bay. Christian, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think people being violent towards these things, it's to show, like, they're angry, and they really are angry, because this decision is going to have a major effect on their lives. And people use anger and violence, you know, to get what they want. And it has worked sometimes, and it's not the best method, but they do use it, and it's worked in cases. So I think people are going to continue to be violent. I don't think it's not good to be violent, but it does work, and it showcases what they're doing.
Christian, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there. I want to start with Christian's concern that people may see violence as something that works to affect change on their behalf. Brian, what do we know about that?
Great question. First of all, Christian Science Monitor some years ago published some very interesting compilation of studies that showed that actually violence is less successful than nonviolence. But let me move on from that to the main point that your caller made, which I think was very interesting and an excellent one. And that is, in recent surveys, the new Roe era that we're in, we had a 20-year high in the number of Americans saying that violence was a legitimate way to resolve political disputes. But it was heavily tipped to the hard right, 30%, whereas on the left, it was 10%. Now that we've seen some inflection points, what I can tell you is I think that this kind of conflict will escalate. But again, I think a really good analog would be 2020, the social justice protests. The social justice protests were overwhelmingly nonviolent. Yes, there were some that weren't. But we also saw in June 2020, a record number of hate crimes against African Americans, and it seemed to correlate with this upsurge in social justice protests. So what I'm saying to you is, even when we have peaceful responses to visceral, highly charged events like the George Floyd lynching, or in this case, the Roe decision looking like it's going to be overturned, that will be an inflection point. And what we've seen with the data, whether it's aggression online or related type of hate crime, these spikes in intergroup tension and violence are getting more elongated. And we're also seeing them occur around political events. If we can just real briefly, if we can just look at a proxy, just using hate crime as a proxy, we've seen, for instance, the worst day in 2019 was around impeachment. The worst month last decade was November 2016, and the worst day in over a decade was the day after elections. So what I'm saying to you is what we have is a very amorphous type of associations where people will get quite genuinely affected. And most of these people will do peaceful things, but there will be those that are trying to exploit it, and these manipulators may not even be partisans. We've seen this kind of interference come from places like Russia and other countries over recent years. And unfortunately, social media has been the sticky swap meet where people can develop an a la carte type of position. And there are those who would want to exploit that. And what I'm afraid of is as the attention escalates, we already have an infrastructure on the far right that is more likely to have firearms and to be organized in a certain way. Not saying that there may not be aggression on the hard left, but we have not seen a lot of it yet. What we've seen in Wisconsin and Texas, for instance, are a first salvo, and it might mean what we often see is when conflict escalates, it escalates on each side with one side predominating. And I think the predominant, we don't know yet. Let's put it that way. Let's see what happens. We're at an inflection point.
Thanks for the call, Christian. We're talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, talking about political and social factors that lead to extremism in the wake of the arson targeting a Wisconsin anti-abortion rights organization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this, the potential for risk of violent extremism, or do you see things in our society that says, hey, maybe we can disagree and argue, but keep it peaceful along the way? What do you want to see from leaders across the political spectrum? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about extremism in the wake of the leaked draft decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade. Brian Levin stays with us, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your worries, your hopes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Eagle River. Pat, hi.
Yeah, I have a question. More or less a question. The Black Lives Matter group this past summer had a protest all over the United States for various reasons, and almost every one of them had vandalism in them, where the stores were being ransacked, robbed, burnt, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage, vandalism. Who bears responsibility for that? I mean, is it the black people that bear responsibility for that, or is it the law enforcement agencies? Where does that come down?
Pat, thanks for the call. Brian, what do you think?
Well, first, let's get some facts straight. According with respect to insurance losses, well over $1 billion in damage. However, Princeton University, ACLED group, they found that about just under 95% were peaceful. Also, let's look at some of the leadership. Al Sharpton, Ben Crump, and the families of people who were killed in police custody at the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks rally, each speaker decried violence. Each speaker did not say that they were very resilient in saying that they did not regard reform as being anti-police. So if you actually listen to the leadership, that's what you get. But look, bottom line is, no matter what, June 2020, where we had a surge of mostly peaceful protests, according to Princeton University, over 94%, we also had the worst month for anti-black hate crime since FBI data collection had started. It was also the worst month for anti-white, going back to 92 around the Rodney King police verdicts. So Unfortunately, one of the things that we have to understand when we look at this in a merely partisan lens is when we see heightened levels of conflict, people in their own echo chamber, and a sudden change or something that is catalytic, and in this case, it's both, I think we can expect a certain increase in conflictual behaviors. The question is, are we going to have an infrastructure of people who are either extremists or in an extremist network that will go even further? And in the past, what we've seen, for instance, when we saw stories of Antifa and BLM having busloads and plane loads going to various communities completely fabricated, we saw a response by self-styled militias. We saw, for instance, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers be involved in numerous conflictual public demonstrations and occupations in the run-up to the insurrection. So unfortunately, we have an infrastructure on one side and a highly charged catalytic event on the other, and we are quite concerned. We don't want to see anybody hurt. But if one thing I can tell you, what's happened in Wisconsin seems to me to be a job by someone who is more than just a dilettante. In other words, that they really have an ideological frame for this. And my guess is they're in some kind of network, even an informal and possibly small one. Remember, the Democratic Party itself, look at the Washington Post, did a story saying, please, protesters, keep it peaceful. Because what happens, I think, for those who are very concerned about what's going on, is that don't let the focus be on conflict. Let it be on the right that is deprived.
Pat, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Given, I hope, Brian, that all of us agree that we'd like to see less violence rather than more, are there proven things that, I don't know, political leaders can do and or say to help prevent that and to have people channel their energy into political means?
Yes, but first of all, it's a great point. We saw hate crimes against Muslims drop precipitously the day after and into the next year when President Bush talked about tolerance toward Muslims. Conversely, we saw hate crimes against Muslims go up when the Muslim ban proposal was presented. But here's the problem. We are so splintered and we are getting our information from so many places, and there is indeed a division industry. Look at what Tucker Carlson, the highest rated show in primetime cable news, is doing. So the problem is these printed circuits of stereotypes, which Dr. Williams from Cornell talked about, labels a constellation of people and groups as legitimate targets for aggression. And what I'm afraid of, conflictual political environment, when we have people who are manipulating this and aggression seems to be paying off politically, that has a reverberative effect. As I always like to say, extremism is a carnival mirror reflection of conflicts and debates that are going on in the mainstream. But what if that glass is cracked too? So yes, certainly, civic leaders should speak out irrespective of what side they're on. But in an era that has foreign and domestic manipulation of social media, conspiracy theories, and systems that are set up where people are on different strata that eventually become funnels that can take people when they are highly charged and have them believe things and do behaviors that they wouldn't otherwise do, represents to me a time of both political, economic, and sociocultural stress that we're just going to have more people who will not only rub elbows, but will go down that funnel. And that's what I'm concerned about. We have infrastructures on both sides that can escalate things. But of course, what I'm very concerned about, on the one hand, what we've seen so far has not been directed against violence against people. On the Army of God and these other folks who were traditionally involved in going after abortion providers, they have crossed the transom. So what I'm saying is we have one side that has a systemic use of, for instance, violence and even militia-type organizing. Another side that now has just started, if this is genuine, using violence, but it's directed against property. The bottom line is, as opposed to casting blame, I'll just close with this. Violence, once that comes out of the toothpaste tube, does not go back in. And what I'm concerned about is folks like the Civil Guard. We saw what happened in Kenosha. Will take already existing conflictual events and escalate them while being armed. And we will also have enough fodder for memes and others to exploit any side all over the virtual world.
We just have a few moments left. A caller on the line, Brian, asking if this event in Madison should be considered domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Easy. All right.
It's not an opinion. Hold on. I'm going to get all kinds of mail on this. When you use violence, threat, or intimidation, particularly with the commission of a crime like arson, that is meant to influence a subgroup, that comes under the definition of domestic terrorism. It's not my definition. What you have to do is, let's pretend we don't know what that office did, but it was firearm for ideological reasons. That, you know, that comes under the definition of terrorism. There's an ideological component, there's criminal violence, and it's directed to intimidate a subgroup. That's what the vandalism itself said. You're not safe.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. We talked about factors that contribute to violent extremism, including what might happen in the aftermath of this draft ruling on Roe v. Wade. You can always weigh in with your thoughts and follow the latest news on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the state's top infectious disease doctor joins the show for a look at the latest COVID updates. The good news about declining numbers over the last bunch of months, the risks from future variants of the virus, the status of vaccinations, and more, plus answers to your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to a state Lyme disease expert about how to prevent tick bites this summer. Now, there are more than 400 private and public caves here in Wisconsin, and our next guest is a big fan of preserving them, exploring them, and helping other people explore them safely. Casey Fisk is chairman of the Wisconsin Speleological Society. The nonprofit organization is involved with cave mapping, research, tours, and more. Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be aboard.
Can you give us a taste of the kind of caves we have here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, most of the caves in Wisconsin are typically crawling caves. We don't have the large caves like we do down in Tennessee or Kentucky. The reason being is because of the different types of limestone that we have here in the state.
And what is it about caves that captured your interest?
Well, today would be the coolness of the cave.
Much better
to be underground right now than it is up on the surface. But it's one of the last frontiers on the earth as far as exploration. I think that's the biggest draw that I have. I just never know what I'm going to find. Maybe the first person that's ever seen anything that's underground.
If someone is interested in checking out caves and doesn't know where to start, what would you recommend as their first bit of exploration?
Well, the first thing I would suggest people would do to actually go to one of our show caves in Wisconsin. There's currently 4 show caves in Wisconsin. Probably the best one to start with would be Ledgeview Nature Center in Chilton, Wisconsin. Reason being is because it's non-lit caves that you're going into, and you actually will be crawling through the caves, whereas some of the other caves are all walking in lit passages.
Now, what's the difference? I see these words, spelunking and caving. What's the difference between the two?
Spelunkers are what we would call as non-professional cavers in the fact that they're inexperienced. Our thing that we always say about spelunkers is cavers actually have to go and rescue spelunkers. Spelunkers go into caves maybe with just a flashlight. They don't have the proper equipment. They get lost. Their lights go out, and they have to be rescued. And it's usually cavers that actually have to go in and rescue the person.
So starting with those show caves would be the good step for spelunkers, because you know, they're a little more attended there, it sounds like.
Correct. That's give you a feel of the underground. And actually, like I said, at Ledgewood Nature Center or at Maribel Caves County Park, where we currently have most of our activities, to actually get in the cave and be crawling around in the dirt, see if you can enjoy it. So that would be where I would start.
And I know the Speleological Society is concerned, you know, about doing this all safely, but also you're interested in preserving caves. What kind of things are important to know about?
Well, our organization has been doing a lot of restoration work in caves. There is, we'll go in and actually do excavation work in the cave to restore them. You had mentioned earlier in the startup that there's 400 caves in Wisconsin. That's only represents about 10% of the caves that are actually here. Reason we don't have a lot of caves is because the glaciers filled them all in. So we as an organization have been restoring caves by taking out the glacial sediment. And then that provides access for people to come into the caves.
Now, if people get a little more advanced and they want to check out caves on their own, I know a really big issue also is making sure you get permission and not just bopping onto private property. What do people need to know?
Correct. Well, that's one thing. If they contact us, we're not going to give out cave locations, because most of the caves in Wisconsin are on private property, and we just don't want people trespassing, and that leads to vandalism in the caves. And so what you should do is, you know, get involved with Wisconsin Speleological Society, and then we would actually then probably allow you to go on some of our field trips where we go to different caves, and you get, you know, find out where the caves are at that point. But, you know, we have to trust the people that go in. We just don't give out locations of caves.
I know there's a concern about bats and white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. How do you and your colleagues at the society help make sure that we humans aren't spreading that?
Well, it's actually, that's a misnomer. Humans really do not spread. I know there, some people might disagree with that, but bats are commercial or communal animals. You know, they spread it themselves. They're always in the caves, they'll lick each other and stuff, and they spread it faster than we can. But for us as an organization, we stopped caving in the wintertime because that's when bats are hibernating in Wisconsin. So we don't do any caving at all in the wintertime if there's bats in the cave. There's an exception. If there's not bats in the cave, then we'll actually be working in the caves or caving.
And you mentioned various things going on this summer, good places to go. If people want to check out cave tours, what are some of the best opportunities for them over the next few months?
Yeah, we actually, as an organization, provide cave tours. And they're always the third Sunday every month, May through October. And we have our main cave that we've excavated out up by Cherney Maribel Caves County Park. That's right off I-43 between Green Bay and Manitowoc. And we provide the tours there the third Sunday every month for free. We do kind of ask for a $5 donation for a family, and you get a really nice caving patch. But that's a great place to go. This year we also have on July 16th was a Saturday. That's a public tour. And this year we're doing for the first time candlelight tours in the cave, which will be July 2nd and 3rd. And that's all up at Maribel.
Casey, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. That's Casey Fisk, chairman of the Wisconsin Speleological Society. We talked to him about his effort to explore and protect caves around Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the hunt for the state's oldest tree.
The oldest known tree in Wisconsin looks nothing like you'd expect. It's not a huge, majestic tree. In fact, it's so unremarkable that it's easy to miss. WPR's Rob Menser has been looking for this tree for years, and he brings us the story of his search.
This is the story of a hike I took and how, after years of looking, I finally found the oldest tree in Wisconsin. Maybe. Sort of.
So where am I looking?
I think it could be one of those. I guess we don't know. Okay. When I imagined Wisconsin's oldest tree, I pictured a massive red oak with limbs the size of telephone poles. But that's not it at all. The oldest tree in Wisconsin, the oldest one we know about anyway, is a scrawny little red cedar that's growing out of the side of a cliff. I got interested in this tree about 4 years ago. I was working for a newspaper at the time, and I interviewed Douglas Larson, the scientist who discovered it in 1997. What he found was that cliffs all over the world support some of the oldest life on Earth. In Wisconsin, on a cliff formation called the Niagara Escarpment, he sampled a cedar tree that was nearly 1,300 years old. But the tree is hard to find. It's on private property in Brown County. I tried to track it down, I talked to people who had seen it, and I wrote that story for the newspaper, but I never did get to see the tree for myself.
I only learned that the tree existed a couple of years ago.
So wait, did you learn about this tree from me?
Yes, kind of. It was your article.
That's Jody Davies. She and her partner Clayton own a cannabis shop in Wrightstown.
And so I was literally asking everyone I knew that would come in, like, have you heard of this tree? Do you know where it is? Is it really here? And nobody knew.
Until one day, one of her customers said, yeah, I know where it is. I can take you out there. In September, Jody sent me a message on Facebook. Hi, Rob, she wrote. I was wondering if you ever found that tree. We're having a small field trip to go see it, and I wondered if you'd like to come along. I tried to play it cool, but yeah, I wanted to come along.
The Niagara Escarpment is actually...
At the Wrightstown Fire Station, a small group of us watched a documentary about the Niagara Escarpment.
I like to think of it as the ancient backbone of North America.
Hundreds of millions of years ago, this was the shoreline of a prehistoric lake. The same cliffs that create Niagara Falls in upstate New York wind through Wisconsin. Dennis Bining, whose house is at the bottom of the ledge, had gotten permission to bring the group of us on a hike to see the tree. The problem was, he told Jody, we couldn't get that close.
We had that tornado come through in 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's going to be tough to get to the base of the ledge because of the devastation.
The other problem was the cliffs are hundreds of feet high. We got as close as we could to the tree, but it was still pretty far away. Dennis let us look through his binoculars, but if I'm honest, I wasn't 100% sure which tree growing out of the side of the cliff was the tree.
Did you get closer when you did your story?
No.
I didn't get this close, no.
Gotcha.
I drove down that road.
And that was it. That was as close as we got. On the walk back, we tried to convince ourselves that we'd accomplished the mission.
Very cool.
I mean, we saw it.
We did see it. We aren't sure exactly... Which one?
But our eyes saw it.
Why can a scrubby little cedar tree growing from the side of a cliff live for 1,300 years? The face of a cliff is a terrible place to grow. It doesn't get good water. It doesn't have rich soil. But here's the secret. When you're growing from a cliff, no one bothers you. Most of the time, people can't even find you. But we did find the tree. We did get to see it. You know, probably.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on Wisconsin's oldest tree. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the warmer weather means more time outside and the return of ticks. We'll talk to an expert about how to prevent Lyme disease. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This heat wave is a sure sign that summer is on its way, but that also means that ticks are back out in Wisconsin's wildlife. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and we want to help you prevent tick bites in the first place and prevent possible infection when you're out and about this summer. Rebecca Osborne is a vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm guessing most people have the message at this point, but just to make sure, Lyme disease is kind of a big deal in Wisconsin, right?
It is, unfortunately. We are considered one of those hotspots or high-incidence states for Lyme disease, so that just means we have a lot of Lyme disease infections every year, unfortunately. And so it's important to try and think about prevention.
When do we need to think about it? You know, is it only when we're going deep into the forest or even in our own backyard? Where and when do we need to be aware of this?
Yeah, so the tick that spreads Lyme disease is called the black-legged tick, also kind of more familiar a name might be the deer tick, and it's really associated with wooded areas. So if you live near a wooded location, it could, you know, crawl into your backyard, even if it's a lawn. Otherwise, if you're out hiking or walking the dog and you're next to the woods or walking through tall grass, even, you might come into contact with this tick. So it can occur in every county in the state, but again, those specific habitat types are really its favorite spot to hang out.
Okay, so let's start with the effort to not get a tick on us in the first place. What are our main get ready precautions?
Sure. So I like to think of it as sort of three steps of prevention. You can think about it before you go outside, during your time outside, and then after your time outside. And before is really thinking about, you know, trying to keep the ticks off you in the first place. So we recommend using an EPA or an Environmental Protection Agency registered insect repellent. And that can be one of many options. Many people have heard of DEET, but there's a lot of other options, including picaridin or oil of lemon eucalyptus. These are things that you spray directly on your skin or clothing. And it's always important to, you know, follow the label instructions carefully. There's also something you can use called permethrin. It's also considered a contact insecticide. So this is something you don't spray on your skin, but you spray on your clothing, your shoes, even your camping gear. And this is done in advance of your outdoor adventure. And it can kill ticks as well as prevent them from crawling on you for up to something like 5 to 7 washes. So that's a great option as well. While you're outside, it's great to think about just avoiding those high vegetation areas. So try to stay in the middle of the trail, avoid really brushy areas or areas with lots of leaf litter on the ground. This is where the ticks tend to hang out. And then after, very important is to do a tick check. Check your whole body, yourself or your family members. You can always help others in your family, especially kids, check themselves. It's important to remember that some of the juvenile ticks can be as small as a poppy seed, so a really careful check of your entire body is important.
Yeah, so let's do our tick check now. Where are we looking, and how do we know what is a tick, what is not a tick?
Great question. So ticks love to hang out in sort of the hard-to-see places. So, you know, back of your head and your hair, back of your knees, the neck, ears, you know, even places that you might need to use a mirror to find. You know, you can always ask a family member to help you look. I often encourage people to take a bath or a shower within 2 hours of coming indoors, because this is just another opportunity to find anything that might be crawling around you. Ticks can be difficult sometimes to identify, especially if they're really small. They don't move very quickly, but you'll often see them, you know, crawling around. They have 8 legs, and they have pretty big mouth parts, but they can be pretty tiny. So again, just look for anything that might be crawling around or may even be embedded in your skin. If you do get a tick bite, there's no need to panic. You just need to try and remove it as quickly as you can.
It is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, a great time to get outside. We're finding out how to stay safe. Rebecca Osborne is with us, vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Okay, Rebecca, we've got the tick on us. There are a lot of wrong ways to remove a tick. Can you tell us the right way, please?
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation about how is the best way to remove a tick. So here is what we recommend. Go ahead and grab a pair of fine tip tweezers if you have one. Grasp the tick as close to the skin as possible. And you just need to pull upward and out with kind of a firm and steady tension. Here are some things not to do. Definitely don't use nail polish or a match. Try not to cover it in, you know, petroleum jelly. Any of those things are not helpful and may just prolong the time that the tick is embedded in your skin, which can increase your chance of infection. If you don't happen to have a fine tip tweezers, you can go ahead and use your fingers. We just recommend that you shield your fingers with, you know, a piece of tissue or some rubber gloves if possible.
And the remain calm point there. You know, when we find the tick, I'll speak for myself. I might freak out a little. I shouldn't, though.
Yeah, it can certainly be disconcerting to have a tick bite. Nobody likes them, but not every tick carries germs and not every tick bite results in infection. So if you do get a tick bite, like we mentioned, go ahead and remove it as quickly as you can. And we do recommend after you remove it that you just watch yourself for symptoms for the next 30 days. So that would be looking for a fever or a rash or other flu-like symptoms that might develop, again, up to a month after you remove that tick. And that may indicate that you have been infected with either Lyme disease or another tick-borne illness. So we recommend you call your doctor right away if you do develop symptoms, and just talk to them about the tick bite that you had and when you had it. So it's good to mark it on your calendar. You can even save the tick in a plastic bag if that's helpful. Sometimes identifying the species of tick can help figure out if you're at high risk or low risk of a tick-borne disease.
Now, a lot of times people talk about that bullseye rash from a Lyme-contaminated tick bite. But, correct me if I'm wrong, you can get Lyme disease even if you didn't get that rash?
Yeah, that's correct. So an estimated 70% to sometimes 80% of people with Lyme disease will develop the classic bullseye rash. But there's that other proportion of the population that will either never develop the rash, or maybe you were bitten, for example, on the back of your head and you developed the bullseye rash but could never observe it. So it's still important to keep in mind that you may get sick with Lyme disease without having that bullseye rash. So that's why we recommend people also look for fever and other flu-like symptoms, you know, fatigue, just generally feeling unwell, joint pain, muscle pain, things like that might indicate a tick-borne disease.
And we've been focusing on humans mainly, but as you mentioned earlier, we might go walking with a dog. What kind of precautions can we take there?
Sure. So we always recommend that you, if you are a pet owner, that you talk to your veterinarian about tick prevention. There's a lot of options for animals, especially dogs, including a Lyme disease vaccine. But tick prevention can come in a topical treatment or an oral treatment. Again, we always make sure that you talk to your veterinarian about what's recommended for your pet. But there are ways to prevent ticks on your pet. And this is also important for human health because dogs especially are really talented at picking up ticks. And then they might come into your home. That tick might crawl off of your dog and onto a person in the house. So that's another way to try and prevent humans from getting bitten by ticks.
And Rebecca, it sounds like we're taking Lyme disease and these ticks pretty seriously. I don't want people to come away, you know, being scared to get out and enjoy nature, right? This is serious, but the benefits of getting out and enjoying nature are pretty serious too, right?
Of course. I mean, Wisconsin is, you know, gifted with so many wonderful places to explore. We have a beautiful, you know, outdoor adventures in our state. So we want people to understand that it's just something you need to keep in mind every time you go outside this time of year. But with a few pretty easy steps, you know, grab some repellent, maybe treat your clothing, think about a tick check when you're done. And that, you know, that can really go a long way from preventing any type of infection. And again, if you do get infected, most tick-borne diseases are treated effectively with antibiotics, which is why it's important to talk to your doctor if you think you might have a tick-borne disease.
Rebecca, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Rebecca Osborne is a vector-borne disease epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She was with us today sharing practical advice on preventing tick bites and preventing Lyme disease this summer so we can enjoy nature, maybe when it cools off just a bit. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, when communities increase their police funding, what happens to local crime numbers? A new study finds more misdemeanor arrests, but not necessarily a lot of impact when it comes to violent crime. One of the researchers behind that study joins the show to share the details. And weeks are 7 days long, right? We're all pretty used to that. But why? Why seven? We'll check out the origins of the Sunday to Saturday system to find out why such an odd number became our standard. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.